Prophecy has to be one of the most exciting subjects that we can consider together, surely, in these last days. And it's lovely that we have days like this where we can meet to talk about these things. Now, many of you will have used the subject of Israel as a great proof of the work of God in these last days. The remarkable fact that Israel, as a punished and scattered and persecuted nation, preserved and regathered and brought back to the land of Israel. Such a remarkable proof for our last day. And lots of you will have used that argument as evidence that God is at work and God's purpose is still being fulfilled amongst the nations even today. I suggest to you, brothers and sisters, that as remarkable as that was, the last 70 years have been even more remarkable. The announcement that a new state had been formed on the 14th of May 1948 was met, you will remember, with a declaration of war by the five neighbouring Arab countries, all of whom said, "We do not want this new country on our doorstep. We will fight these Jews." And you think about the years immediately preceding that time and all the great suffering that Israel had endured, the Jews had endured in mainland Europe. These were quite a ragtag group of people. And yet, under the hand of God, they not only defended themselves, but they secured their borders, they established themselves in the land. And time and again since that period, Israel have been attacked and have defended borders, have increased their land, and have secured their position in the land of Palestine. Remarkable thing indeed, brothers and sisters. And we're going to reflect on some of that here. Not so much the history, but the nation of Israel as it is today. And overarching all this is the sentiment that we get from Isaiah 43. I took you here because this is one of those passages which talk about the great things which God has done for his people, and yet they are not willing to be his. They are not wanting to be followers of Almighty God. I suspect many of you will have used verse 10. I didn't read that deliberately because it's well known. The first half is very well known. Verse 10, where God says, "Ye are my witnesses," and we use their history as proof that they are his witnesses. But that's not what God wanted. He wanted them to be witnesses because they lived the truth. They followed his principles. They lived according to his standards. And all men and all nations could see it and respond accordingly. And that obligation and responsibility is ours this day, brothers and sisters. If we think we are the people of God, we should be those very witnesses who are standing up for the things of God in this age. Israel did not do that. And despite all the blessings which God has put on them, they are still refusing to do that. They are a people that should be full of God, and yet regrettably they are full of themselves. And there's an arrogancy and a superiority amongst a people who should know better. But they have done remarkable things, and together we are going to consider some of those remarkable things. Just before we get going, let's have a quick look at Ezekiel chapter 20, please, if you would. Before we get into our subject, this is the estimation of the land of Israel as far as the Almighty is concerned, and we do well to remember it. Verse 5, Ezekiel 20. "Thus saith the Lord God, in the day when I chose Israel and lifted up mine hand unto the seed of the house of Jacob and made myself known unto them in the land of Egypt, when I lifted up mine hand unto them, saying, I am the Lord your God, in the day that I lifted up mine hand unto them to bring them forth out of the land of Egypt into a land that I have espied for them, flowing with milk and honey, which is the glory of all lands." As far as God is concerned, that little arid desert land, that strip of land at the eastern edge of the Mediterranean, is the glory of all lands. And it might not be today, but one day, brothers and sisters, when living waters flow out of Jerusalem, this is going to be a special place, and God can see that, and he knows that. And this is his plan. So this morning, brothers and sisters, for the time that we've got, we're going to not review so much the history of Israel since it moved into the land, but we are going to consider some of these great successes of this nation, just three or four areas that we'll consider together. And I want to note that their successes have been driven out of their hardships and their restrictions. And there should be great exhortation for all of us there, because we can bring that into our own daily living and look at restrictions and hardships and challenges and not recognise that actually God's blessing. And that blessing in due course becomes evident. And we ought to be aware of that and be patient through difficulties. And we're going to consider finally the attractiveness of this country as a spoil for the other nations who may care to invade. So that's our little plan. Let's talk then about Israel for a few minutes and just remind ourselves of some of the facts and figures about this place. At 20,770 square kilometres, this is one of the smallest countries in the world. Out of 200 so countries, it's number 154. It is tiny, it is insignificant. It's not even as large as Macedonia or Albania. It's a tiny little place. It has a population of 8.85 million, according to the United Nations, of which 74.5% are Jews. That's 0.1% of the population throughout the world, 0.1%. If you add in the Jews who aren't yet back in the land, you could probably double that, couldn't you, to 0.2%. And then when you think of that and look at the impact that the Jew has had on society, modern society, their contribution is astonishing. You will be quotas of how many Nobel Prizes have been won by Jews. I know that. But they're only small, the 100th largest by way of population in the world. Their earning power is quite considerable. This is a wealthy nation. Don't forget that, brothers and sisters. 365 billion, it's difficult to put that into context, isn't it? But that's the 34th largest country. Bigger than neighbours like Egypt, bigger than Portugal or Finland or Denmark, or Singapore, or New Zealand. This is quite a powerful economy that rests at the edge of the Mediterranean. And when you look at that GDP per capita, $41,000, that's 25th in the world. Here in the wealthy UK, we are marginally better at 22. So Israel is almost as rich per capita as we are here in the UK. And the quality of life is phenomenally good. We might not expect that. Life expectancy at 82 years is the eighth best in the world. So Israel in some ways is a remarkable place. And it has a number of advantages which are working out for it. If you look at its population, most Western developed nations are wrestling with the demographics of its population. They're all aging. We're wondering how a younger generation can support an aging generation and an older generation which seems to be living longer and longer. That's a real problem for many developed nations. Not so in Israel. 14 years old and below make up 25%, a quarter of the population. 40% are younger than 25 years. That's remarkable, isn't it? Only 11.4% are 65 years old or above. And this very youthful population, we're going to come on to this a little later, this very youthful population, highly qualified, highly educated. Israel has the highest number of degrees per capita than any other country in the world. The OECD estimates that 45% of the population in Israel has degrees. Highly educated, highly youthful, highly energetic, and a determination to succeed. This is a remarkably a nation with remarkable potential, and a lot of that potential has been developed and is evident. So one or two areas that I want to consider together where Israel has made a difference or contributed or done something remarkable, and with some trepidation I put water on the screen, because you don't want to give an address like this if there's an expert in irrigation, say, in the audience. So with a little nervousness I embark on this, but I know you, an expert you can speak to if I've got anything wrong here. I've chosen water because the areas I've chosen to consider this morning are things that were absolutely essential for the nation of Israel. If people are moving into the land, being able to have a good, reliable, high-quality water supply is essential if they are going to survive in that land. So they're moving into the land of Palestine and they need to survive. It's absolute basic for life. The rainfall in Israel isn't that bad, actually. Jerusalem, apparently the average rainfall in Jerusalem is 550 millimetres per annum, which is only a little bit less than somewhere like Rugby, which is 640 millimetres of rain a year. But the problem is it all rains in the north, and it doesn't rain in the south, very, very little in the south of Israel. So the highly populated areas, the areas where the fertile lands are, the water doesn't seem to get there. They developed the National Water Carrier Scheme, which was built shortly after, or commenced shortly after Israel moved into the land. It took many years to complete, but today it moves 1.7 million cubic metres of water every single day through a series of giant pipes and open canals and tunnels and reservoirs, and it takes it from the north down into the south. Oh, for something like that in the UK. I remember droughts not so many years ago, 20 or 30 years ago, where tankers, road tankers, were filling up at the Kielder Reservoir in the north, driving down to the M62 and depositing their water into a wet, dry reservoir below. And there was a shuttle of water tankers going up and down. Israel have built this national water carrying scheme, which ensures that water gets to the right place. Water is extracted, as you will know, from the Sea of Galilee and from the River Jordan, but that over-extraction has caused a problem. It was one of the factors in the Six-Day War, you might remember. The Syrians were diverting rivers that were flowing into the Sea of Galilee, and Israel were very unhappy about that. So much water is taken out of the River Jordan that a study in 2010 estimated that only 2% of the River Jordan's historic flow reaches the Dead Sea. 2% of its historic flow. And if you've been there and you've seen, you will know it's just a little trickle that arrives at the Dead Sea. No wonder the Dead Sea continues to fall year by year. One of the architects of the National Water Carrying Scheme was the gentleman on the right of the photo there, Simcha Blass. And he was a public servant, he was a Polish Jew, a water engineer who helped with this particular work. But that wasn't his big contribution to water in the land of Israel. If you come across this individual, he was rather remarkable. He was supervising the drilling of a well in southern Israel, on a farm in southern Israel, and he noticed some trees on the boundary of the farm. These trees were all same species, all planted at the same time, all enjoying the same conditions, and you would think, therefore, all would grow at the same rate. One tree did not. One tree on the end was much taller, much healthier, much bushier, and he couldn't understand why, and he wanted to know. And in 1933, as he dug around this tree to find out what was going on, he found there was a leaking water irrigation pipe that was just dripping water onto the roots of the tree at the end. Thus was born, in his mind at least, the idea of micro-irrigation. Now, micro-irrigation wasn't new. Other people had used it. For example, in Germany it had been used, and in 1869 it had been found to be very successful. It had been tried in Australia and other places, so it wasn't new, but he couldn't actually do anything with it whilst he was busy with his National Water Carrier Scheme until he retired from public service in 1959, by which time plastics had been developed and they could help him with his idea. This is how a British farmer waters his field. and he seems to do it by replicating rainfall. Sometimes he does it like that. The water that he squirts onto his field in that way evaporates, or runs off, or doesn't get to the roots of the plant because the leaves get in the way, and it's highly ineffective. This is how an Israeli farmer waters his crops. This is the Simkablas identified micro-irrigation method, where little pipes carrying water to just the right place, little drops just at the roots of these plants. And it's the simplest of things, isn't it, brothers and sisters? And yet it has been the most remarkable impact on the land of Israel. Simkablas discovered that by using 40% less water, he could get the same crop yields. In fact, he could double the crop yields by using 40% less water. That means just to get the same crop, he could use 70% less water. Now that's a remarkable saving. If you think about that, in a thirsty land, simple mechanism of pipes and micro-irrigation and productivity of that level, and you're opening great potential. And those of you who've been to the land of Israel and you've seen that the barren land and the desert land, it's just crying out for water, isn't it? You come across these kibbutzim and they're green and they're fruitful and they're fertile, and you think just a little bit of water here will cause this desert to bloom. And that's exactly what he's been able to do. Some of the results elsewhere, the Netherlands have got crops to grow 550%. More productive through micro irrigation. So it's a remarkable thing. Water shortage is a real problem for the world. The US Director of National Intelligence published a report on global water security in 2012, and that expects that great swathes of the Middle East, Pakistan, India, China, they are going to suffer great shortages arising out of climate change, reduced rainfall, population growth, urbanisation, evolving energy needs, all these things are placing great demands on water supply. These countries will be severely or extremely or exceptionally affected by water shortages. And here is Israel claiming it's got some kind of solution to it. The environmental impact of the way we water is phenomenal. You think of the farmers who are putting their fertilizers down, all the phosphorus and the nitrogen, and we then just cover it in water and it all runs off and it goes into lakes and streams and rivers and pollutes the environment, much more so than air pollution. And here's Israel saying, just put these little drops of water in just the right place and look what will happen to your crops. Remarkable results are seen. But it's not just that. They know that they need to generate clean water in the first place. They have four desalination plants. This is the fifth, which came online recently, and it's the largest in the world. Doesn't use any new technology. It's using the same kind of technology that desalination plants have generally, and yet they found a way of doing it in scale, big time, with cheap inputs, and as a consequence, they can now provide 20% of Israeli households with the water that they need. This one plant provides 20% of households in Israel with their requirements. 627,000 cubic meters per day. But it's not just generating the water. Once the water is generated and used, they want to recycle it. Think of a country like Spain, which has a very similar environment to Israel. Spain has water shortages. Spain too tries to recycle its used water. Spain is very good at it. It's the second best in the world. Spain recycles and reclaims 25% of its water. Israel is number one in the world and it reclaims 85% of its water. And the other 10%, the other 15% of the other 15%, 10% is used for forest fires and to boost the river flows. So they're using 95% of recycled water. It's only 5% lost. Israel has a very determined approach to looking after its water. If you had to pay for your water by the litre, like you do with your diesel or your petrol, you'd think about it very differently. That's how a Jew thinks about his water. Very protectively, very scarcely, they look after their water. They are so arrogant about this, if I may, that they think they have solved the world's water problem. This man who's written this book, Seth Siegel, he's written his book to tell the world how to solve its water problem. And you can see that that idea, that kind of capability, would be something in a world that is short of water. Now notice this capability has come out of the God-given environment in which this people live. They needed water. Look at the things they have developed out of the hardships and the difficulties of that particular environment. Let's talk about agriculture for a few minutes. I've not got very many of these, brothers and sisters, and we will go through them quickly. But you think about agriculture in Israel. This was a really desolate land when the first Zionists moved in. Semi-arid, untillable, it suffered from deforestation, it suffered from soil erosion, it suffered from neglect. We often quote that verse in Leviticus, don't we, about the land enjoying its Sabbaths. I think the Zionists who arrived didn't think it had been much of a Sabbath, really. This just looked a desolate, abandoned land that needed a lot of work to put it back into use. Rocky fields had to be cleared, terraces had to be constructed, swampland had to be drained, forests had to be replanted, salty soil had to be washed. All these great manual tasks had to be done. And as a consequence, these people were able to feed themselves. Just come with me to Deuteronomy chapter 8, would you? These people who needed food, these people who wanted to secure for themselves a food supply, were driven to turn this land into something fertile. Look at what God said to his people in the wilderness back in Deuteronomy 8, verse 3. He humbled thee and suffered thee to hunger and fed thee with manna which thou knewest not. And there's something of that today, brothers and sisters. These people have been allowed to suffer hunger and the privations of moving into this desolate land in order that they could see God's blessing. Whether or not they do is another matter. But God allowed them to hunger. Just put that into context with your own sufferings and your own hardships. God doesn't want to, but he's allowing it to happen so that you can learn and ultimately find a blessing from it. And of course, the children of Israel then, the Jews, today have done something remarkable with it. They have indeed turned this into a very fruitful land. Initially, in 1948, about 400,000 acres could be cultivated. Now it's over 1 million acres. They've increased that by 2.5 times. But still, this is a difficult land. Only 20% of the land in Israel can be farmed. And yet, that 20% of land has seen productivity grow by more than 16 times. They're producing 16 times more food on that land than could be done in 1948. That's a remarkable thing, isn't it, when you think about how this people work. According to the Ministry of Agriculture in Israel, the productivity has risen 4.5-fold, which with the land increase gets us to the 16 times, and the produce per unit of water has increased 4-fold. This is a remarkable thing, and Israel does not stand still, always inventing, always trying to find a better way of doing things. Why plant a crop of wheat that's going to grow waist high? Why waste all that energy growing a plant this high when all you're interested in is the wheat itself that you can use to make your bread? Why not make it grow knee high? And have that tall enough So they now grow short wheat that doesn't use a lot of water. They've inbred from wild wheat so that it's more robust, it's more resistant to disease and pestilence. All sorts of things are going on in the land of Israel. It's described, isn't it, as this land of milk and honey. I have said unto you, you shall inherit their land, and I will give it unto you to possess it, a land that floweth with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God, which has separated you from other people. I don't know whether you associate Israel with the dairy industry. That's the sort of thing you think of Somerset or Devon, and you picture these cows wandering happily in green fields and able to munch on grass in this country, and all looks very idyllic. And I'm sure our cows are very happy cows and very productive cows. They generate something like 7,800 litres of milk a year because they're happy cows. In America, they produce more than 10,000 litres of milk a year. In Israel, 12,000 litres. They don't have any grazing. They feed their cows with what they want to feed them. They feed them just the right things, in just the right way, at just the right time. They cool their cows so that they feel happy. They cool them just before milking and found that milk yields went up. This is a nation that works very hard at the simplest of things and now have the most productive cows in the world. There's something to write in your book of little known facts, that this is the nation of Israel. And beekeeping, it's a land of milk and honey. They look after their bees. They're not so much worried about the honey, even though they generate 3,500 tons of honey every year. They're interested in bees because of the benefit of pollination. It's vital to the other crops in their area. They estimate that the value of the bee population in Israel is 30 times more than the value of the honey that they generate. So they look after their bees. And when bee populations have been falling in other nations like the UK and the US, Israel have been managing their bee population much better. It is a land flowing with milk and honey. Let's just talk about the military, if we may, for a moment. The military in Israel is one of the most remarkable things. And again, this is driven out of need. It's one thing to find water for the people. It's one thing to find food for the people. These people needed defending, as they found within 24 hours of the State of Israel being declared. Shimon Peres has these words, Israel bred creativity proportionate not to the size of our country, but to the dangers we faced. Israel had to develop military capability quickly in order that it could defend itself against the nations who were hostile to it. You will know that Israel is one of those countries that has compulsory national service. Young people here, when you get to 18 years old, you are expected to enlist in the army. Boys, you will serve 32 months. It's recently reduced from 36 months. Girls, you will serve 24 months. It's compulsory. You will join the army. Afterwards, some re-enlist because they like army life and will stay on longer. Some will go on to study for their degrees. But the training of these young people is absolutely intense. Soldiers have very high expectations placed upon them. They, as young people, are going to see service. And these are real life and death situations. We've watched the news footage, haven't we? We've seen Israeli soldiers at work. These are the young people of Israel. And some of you will have seen them. You'll have walked around the Old City of Jerusalem and you've seen young people with powerful weapons strapped across their shoulders. I was impressed how controlled and self-assured they looked. Imagine going back to your ecclesia and handing out powerful weapons to your senior CYC and seeing what the consequences may or may not be. These were very controlled, very together young people who have been well trained and know what they are about. And the service that they have to do in the army brings together a family bond which isn't going to be found anywhere else. When you are in a life and death situation with your colleagues, that forms a bond which is going to stay there for life. And it does. And these soldiers, when they leave the army, they have to serve as reserves, serving 2 or 4 weeks every year to keep their training up to scratch until well into their 40s or 50s. They reunite, they reconnect with these same units that they've served with. And this bond ties the population of Israel together. And the military units are highly sought after. Yeah, it's a little bit like youngsters in this country who might want to go to Oxford or might want to go to Cambridge or might covet the best place at a university. It's the army units, the elite units that are of interest to the young people. And the military start looking at children. Who's got the best prospects? Who are we going to aim for our elite units so that they can get the best training and we can get the best out of them? There's real competition. People like to have on their CV that they served in this particular elite unit. When they go for job interviews, the question isn't which school did you go to, which university did you go to, what qualifications did you got, where did you do your service, who did you serve with, what action did you see, because that builds people, it builds character, it builds capability. And these are young people who are all committed to the survival of their country. They are dedicated soldiers, and this is a powerful force that's developing here in Israel. And it's not just that they're committed and eager and keen on serving in the army. They are given lots of authority. They are expected to work things out for themselves. It's not like the UK Army or the US Army where you wait for orders from above. Israeli soldiers don't do that. They are expected to think on their feet. Yom Kippur has become one of the most infamous tank battles in history. And it was in that particular encounter that Israeli tanks, which thought they were absolutely supreme, impregnable, came under real difficulty. They hadn't realised that a Russian weapon, a Russian missile called the Saga, had been given to the Egyptians. The Saga was a fearsome thing. Some shoulder launch soldier can sit 2 miles away, and as long as he can see the tank, he can direct the missile. It was wire guided with a little joystick. He could direct the missile to the Israeli tank. The Israelis did not know what was happening, and these tanks kept exploding. Someone spotted a red light on a tank and realized that missiles were being guided to it. And now they needed to work out what to do. They couldn't wait for orders. Oh, there's another tank gone. We need to think quickly. What are we going to do here? And improvising, they decided just to create a smoke screen. So they all started driving around furiously and smoke came up so that they couldn't see where, so the enemy couldn't see where the tanks were. And then the Israeli army started firing furiously in the direction of where they thought the missile was coming from. That was just made up on the spur of the moment on a battlefield. And after the Yom Kippur War became established NATO policy for dealing with defence against the Saga rocket, Jews thought of that on their feet in a real life or death situation. That's just one little example of how this worked. And as a consequence, the Israel military thinks like that on its feet all the time. And it will ensure that things are done to satisfy and ensure its protection. Iron Dome is a remarkable thing when you think about it, isn't it? Imagine your only defence against an incoming bullet is to fire it out of the sky with another bullet. That's what Iron Dome is like. Incoming missiles are shot out of the sky with over 85% accuracy. The Americans can't do that. You may have spotted in the news just a couple of weeks ago, the Americans have started buying Iron Dome because they can't do it quite for themselves. They won't admit that, but they can't. This is remarkable technology. And in an age where Russia are saying, well, we're going to start rebuilding our missiles, we're going to start our program, we're developing hypersonic missiles. You'll have read all this this material. Here's a country that's got the capability, potentially, of stopping that. It's a remarkable thing, brothers and sisters, and it's driven out of a need to defend themselves. The Merkava tank named after the war chariots of Solomon, interestingly. This is a super tank as far as infantry are concerned, and it's the only tank in the world that puts its engine at the front, not because it wants an engine at the front and it thinks a front-mounted engine is superior, but because it protects the soldiers. All the other tanks in the world have their engines in the back, and the soldiers therefore are more vulnerable. Israel does it the other way around. It puts the tanks, the engines in the back. And it's a remarkable piece of battlefield warfare, all driven from a need to defend itself and care for itself, which leads to the most interesting group of people who reach the age of 23. All these young people who've been enlisted into the Israeli Defense Force and have got their degrees at 23 years old are highly trained, very mature, very balanced and reasoned people. They have experienced life, they've got a good education, and they're now coming out into the business world. This is a remarkable resource which the nation of Israel has. You compare that with our young people at 23, with the greatest of respect to all 23-year-olds in the room today. Who might have been to college, who might have been to university, who might have done a year out somewhere doing something which might have involved a bit of travel and probably not a lot else. Very different. And these people want to succeed. They want to contribute. They want to do the things that the army trained them to do. Very grateful to the brother who recommended this book to me, Israel, Startup Nation. I commend it to you if you're interested in this kind of thing, because it just encapsulates the attitude of these people who are determined to make their nation succeed. This is a picture of Silicon Wadi. We smile at Silicon Wadi, don't we? This outside Silicon Valley has the highest concentration of companies, of IT companies, anywhere in the world. Over 3,000 IT companies are based here, and everybody wants to be here. Lots of major companies are here. They set up their headquarters here. This is a country that can deliver and can do. Motorola developed the mobile phone in Israel. Voicemail technology was developed in Israel. The first antivirus software commercially launched in 1991. Dr. Solomon, for those of you who have a memory that goes back that far, developed here in Israel. Memory sticks, pill cameras, all sorts of things in the medical field. These have come from Israel. Silicon Wadi, just outside Tel Aviv in Israel. Most companies quoted on the Nasdaq, apart from the US, Israeli companies. Intel, the biggest major, the biggest private employer in Israel. Microsoft has more employees in Israel per capita than anywhere else in the world. And this can-do attitude ensures that these companies succeed and develop. But it's jolly hard work. This is a quote from Muli Eden, who's the president of Intel, or was the president of Intel in Israel. He said, "It's more complicated to manage five Israelis than 50 Americans, because they will challenge you all the time, starting with, why are you my manager? Why am I not your manager?" And that's the attitude of these people. They want to get on, they want to do things. One of the famous things that's come out of Israel is the microprocessing chip. When this was being developed, you might remember that computer speed was the big thing. I've got a 286 computer, or I've got a 386 computer. Mine's a 486 now. Mine's got an Intel Premium. Do you remember all that as we were going through those different stages? And all that was happening at the time was computer companies were getting their processing chips to go faster and faster and faster. And as they did that, they had to build more hardware around it to make them go cooler and cooler, because they were just heating up. People in Israel, Intel in Israel, said, we can find a better way. And they came up with a microprocessing chip which moved at a much slower speed but had much greater processing capacity. They went to America to tell their bosses about this new invention that they'd come up with, thinking their bosses would be delighted. Their bosses weren't persuaded at all, because the share price of a company was directly related to the speed of its processing chip. So as the speed went up, the share price went up, and they were worried about announcing that, oh, ours will go a lot slower now. They were very worried about that. And it took a lot of persistence of the Intel unit in Israel to get the people to use this new chip. You don't have big fans in your PCs anymore? That's because Israel has sorted this out. Cellebrite will probably not be the household name in IT. I don't think it's used particularly in any of the areas that you and I might operate in. But when the FBI captured a phone from a terrorist who'd committed murder in San Bernardino in California, they were trying to persuade Apple to unlock it for them. And you remember that standoff that almost went to the Supreme Court, Apple taking the moral high ground, saying, we're not going to do that for you, and the FBI trying to force them to do it. Cellebrite was the company who put their hand up and said, send it to us. 4 days later, the phone was back, all the data extracted from it, and the case in America went away because the FBI had got what they wanted. Apple are furious. They're wanting to find out how Cellebrite did it. And if you look on Cellebrite website, if you're a police force or a crime prevention agency, it says, send your information to us. We'll find it for you. And that's what they do. And it's all there in Israel. This is a company. This is a country of people who will do. And then there's this last little section that I've got on energy. And it's a remarkable thing, isn't it? You will know how these oil and gas finds are coming out. The Tamar field is quite remarkable. The Leviathan field is coming on stream later this year. Israel has got oil shale deposits in the Negev. And once the technology is perfected for extracting that, some geologists think there'll be enough energy to last Israel for 300 years. And of course, Israel is not just thinking about looking after itself, it's thinking about what it's going to do with this, and it wants to export this gas to different places. Now, the question which we have asked as a community for years is, why doesn't Israel have any oil? Have you not heard that question? That's been a big puzzle, hasn't it, for us all? God is blessing his people, and yet all the Arab nations round about seem to have oil which was just below the ground. They could pump it out to their heart's content. They were becoming rich and wealthy and ruling the world, holding the world to ransom because they had oil which commanded strong negotiating positions. They could hold even superpowers to ransom. Why didn't God give any oil to Israel? Why is it suddenly being discovered now? Why 40, 50 years later, all of a sudden, are Israel finding it? Hasn't that been a worry for us? I think, brothers and sisters, the answer lies in the things that we've touched on very briefly together this morning. Israel has been forced to develop a highly diverse, highly successful economy that feeds its people, that provides for its needs, that generates wealth, that looks after the well-being of its population. It's been forced to do that. And now the oil has come along and it's an added bonus. You compare that with somewhere like Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is just oil. Can you think of anything else that comes out of Saudi Arabia? Apart from oil and petrochemicals, I found dates. It exports dates, and there might be one or two other things. 87% of things that Saudi Arabia exports is oil or oil-related. It doesn't need anything else. It just pumps the stuff and gets the money. It's easy. It's a very wealthy country. Saudi Arabia are deeply concerned. What happens if all of a sudden the world stops using petrol in its cars? What happens if the world suddenly doesn't need oil? They have no economy. They have no diversification. They will become what they were before the 1970s, a very poor, backward nation. They're worried about that. Israel has got the strength of an economy to go behind it, whether or not oil supplies and gas supplies flow. Now, we think about the attractiveness of this spoil, brothers and sisters, and I've puzzled over this a little bit, and I'd be very interested in your views as to how this works. Because you can see that any country which is digging oil or digging gas out of, pumping gas out of the ground and exporting it to different places, you can see how that's going to be attractive. Particularly if you're somewhere like Russia and you're building your Nord 2 pipeline and you're wanting to secure in a monopoly fashion all the supplies of gas into Europe, if you're wanting to secure that and all of a sudden there's some little nation here who's pumping lots of other gas in through the back door, that's not welcome. So you can see an immediate attractiveness to Russia, who might want to control or influence or actually take ownership of this particular supply. It's a physical thing. But that's just one thing, isn't it? What about the other things we've talked about? If they invaded and took over the headquarters of Intel or Microsoft in Israel, what would they actually get? You know, it's all up here, isn't it? It's all intellectual capability, inventiveness, creativeness, a determination to contribute for their nation. They wouldn't want to do it for someone else, I don't think. A little bit like Apple saying, we're not going to unlock this for you, Mr. FBI. We're not going to do that. And yet, Apple probably had the engineers who could do it. And similarly, Israel aren't suddenly going to say, yes, Northern invader, we'll use all our creativity to help you. You can't really even force them to do that. Do you remember when the white farmers were driven off the land in Rhodesia? Rhodesia was the bread basket of Africa, wasn't it? The farmers were producing all sorts of crops there. The nationalists drove them out when it became Zimbabwe. They didn't tend the land. They didn't know about their irrigation schemes. And now Zimbabwe is a basket case in Africa, isn't it? And it would be the same kind of thing, wouldn't it? You know, Russia would not know what to do with this. Except that nearly 15% of the Israeli population is Russian and has come from Russia. And you can't just help wondering if there isn't going to be some kind of allegiance, possibly, some kind of nostalgic connection with Russia from where they came. Maybe. Anyway, those are things for us to think about. I want to go to Ezekiel 38, brothers and sisters. Our time is nearly over, but I just want to show you one or two things in Ezekiel 38, because you and I are of the view, understandably, that this northern invader is attracted to the nation in the south because it's such an attractive spoil. And isn't that what's declared? Isn't that what's declared? This is when the northern invader comes down. Verse 11 of Ezekiel 38. I will go up. Thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil and to take a prey. So that's what the northern invader is going to say. I'm coming down because I'm coming to take a prey and I'm coming to take a spoil. That's the declared intent, whether it's by aggression, it sounds very aggressive in this chapter to me, whether it's by subterfuge, whatever means to get hold of that prey, their declared intent is, I want to take a prey. And that's just what the merchants of Tarshish think, isn't it? That's the question. Ask them, Sheba, come and say, art thou come to take a spoil? That's what we think you're here for. Is that right? Can you confirm that? Is that why you are in the land? We therefore spoil and look at the prey, and that's what I've done. Not to miss the real reason for the invasion. The prey might be attractive. The benefits of the land might be attractive. But just look at verse 10, brothers and sisters, and make sure you appreciate this. It shall come to pass that at the same time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought. And you just do a little bit of concordance work on this this phrase, these two words, an evil thought. And in Proverbs, we're told that the thoughts of the wicked are an abomination to the Lord. So what? Same words there. Whatever it is that the northern invader is thinking in Ezekiel 38, it's an abomination to God. It's the very thing that caused God to destroy mankind when the imaginations of a man's heart was only evil continually. These are the occasions where these two words come together, brothers and sisters. This is a population in absolute opposition to God, in complete disregard to God and his ways. And God destroyed them. And here is a northern invader coming down with an evil thought. The most useful place where these two words come together in Esther chapter 9, where we read about Haman's wicked device. That's not a contraption of some sort, that's evil thought. Same words, but excuse me. Esther 9. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letters that Haman's wicked device, which he devised against the Jews, should return upon his own head. That wicked device, you know, was to destroy the Jews. Do not be persuaded otherwise. Attractive as the spoil is, even if it's difficult to get hold of, the only intent of the northern invader is this evil thought. And it is the destruction of God's people. Now, you and I, brothers and sisters, are privileged, aren't we? We're finished now. You and I are privileged, aren't we, to know that that is not the outcome of the matter. That is not how this will end. Let's finish in Ezekiel 36, shall we? Thus saith the Lord God, in the day that I shall have cleansed you from all your iniquities, I will also cause you to dwell in the cities, and the walls shall be builded, and the wastes shall be builded. And the desolate land shall be tilled, whereas it lay desolate in the sight of all that passed by. And they shall say, this land that was desolate is become like the Garden of Eden, and the waste and desolate and ruined cities are become fenced and are inhabited. Then the nations that are left round about you shall know that I, the Lord, builded the ruined places. This is the work of God. Now one day, brothers and sisters, we might not know all the steps, we might not know all the details, but we know that when the Lord Jesus Christ is back and reigning from Jerusalem, nations, all nations, will know that he is king. There is one Lord in that day. And his name one. We pray that will be soon.